a leg of mutton, cramming the meat into her mouth with both hands. She ate with the ravenous intensity of a gorging wolf, displaying a complete lack of decorum. With her violet eyes hidden and her dragon mark covered by black bangs, she once again appeared to be nothing more than an innocent child. Asuada waited until it became apparent that Elva had said all she was going to. Then, at a gesture from Angela, she accompanied the herbalist through a side door, leaving the pale girl sitting alone in the centre of the dark, cloth-bound room, like a dire fetus nestled in its womb, waiting for the right moment to emerge. Angela made sure that the door was closed and whispered, "All she does is eat and eat. We can't sate her appetite with the current rations. Can you—" "She'll be fed. You needn't worry about it." Asuada rubbed her arms, trying to eradicate the memory of those awful, horrible eyes. "Thank you. Has this ever happened to anyone else?" Angela shook her head until her curly hair bounced on her shoulders. "Not in the entire history of magic. I tried to cast her future, but it's a hopeless quagmire. Lovely word, quagmire. Because her life interacts with so many others." "Is she dangerous?" "We're all dangerous. You know what I mean." Angela shrugged. "She's more dangerous than some and less than others. The one she's most likely to kill, though, is herself. If she meets someone who's about to be hurt and Aragorn's spell catches her unawares, then she'll take the doomed person's place. That's why she stays inside most of the time." "How far in advance can she foretell events?" 2 or 3 hours at the most." Leaning against the wall, Nasuada considered the newest complication in her life. Elva could be a potent weapon if she were applied correctly. "Through her I can discern my opponent's troubles and weaknesses, as well as what will please them and make them amenable to my wishes. In an emergency, the girl could also act as an infallible guard if one of the Varden, like Aragorn or Saphira, had to be protected." "She can't be left unsupervised. I need someone to watch her. Someone who understands magic and is comfortable enough with their own identity to resist Elva's influence, and who I can trust to be reliable and honest." She immediately discounted Triana. Nasuada looked at Angela. Though she was wary of the herbalist, she knew that Angela had helped the Varden with matters of the utmost delicacy and importance, like healing Aragorn, and had asked for nothing in return. Nasuada could think of no one else who had the time, inclination, and expertise to look after Elva. "I realize," said Nasuada, "that this is presumptuous of me, as you aren't under my command, and I know little of your life or duties. But I have a favour to ask of you." "Proceed." Angela waved a hand. Nasuada faltered, disconcerted, then forged ahead. "Would you be willing to keep an eye on Elva for me? I need—" "Of course, and I'll keep two eyes on her if I can spare them. I relish the opportunity to study her." "You'll have to report to me," warned Nasuada. "The poison dart hidden in the raisin tart. Ah, well, I suppose I can manage." "I have your word, then?" "You have my word." Relieved, Nasuada groaned and sank into a nearby chair. "Oh, what a mess! What a quagmire! As Aragorn's liege lord, I am responsible for his deeds, but I never imagined that he would do anything as dreadful as this. It's a blight on my honour as much as his." A ripple of sharp pops filled the room as Angela cracked her knuckles. "Yes, I intend to speak to him about it once he returns from Ellesmere." Her expression was so fierce it alarmed Nasuada. "Well, don't hurt him. We need him." "I won't. Permanently." Resurgence. A blast of ravening wind tore Aragorn from his sleep. Blankets flapped over him as a tempest clawed at his room, hurling his possessions into the air and knocking the lanterns against the walls. Outside, the sky was black with thunderheads. Saphira watched as Aragorn staggered upright and fought to keep his balance as the tree swayed like a ship at sea. He lowered his head against the gale and made his way around the room, clutching at the wall until he reached the teardrop portal through which the storm howled. Aragorn looked past the heaving floor to the ground below. It appeared to rock back and forth. He swallowed and tried to ignore the churning in his stomach. By touch, he found the edge of the cloth membrane that could be pulled out of the wood to cover the opening. He prepared to launch himself from one side of the gap to the next. If he slipped, nothing would stop him from falling onto the roots of the tree.
"Wait," said Saphira.
She backed off the low pedestal where she slept and laid her tail alongside him so that he could use it as a handrail. Holding the cloth with just his right hand, which took all his strength, Eragon used the line of spikes on Saphira's tail to pull himself across the portal. As soon as he reached the far side, he grabbed the cloth with both hands and pressed its edge into the groove that locked it in place. The room went silent. The membrane bulged inward under the force of the angry elements, but showed no sign of giving. Eragon poked it with his finger. The fabric was as taut as a drum.
"It's amazing what the elves can do," he said.
Saphira cocked her head, then lifted it, so that her head was flat against the ceiling while she listened.
"You'd better close up the study. It's being wrecked."
As he headed toward the stairs, the tree jolted and his leg buckled, sending him down hard on one knee.
"Blast it," he growled.
The study was a whirlwind of paper and quills, darting about as if they had a mind of their own. He dove into the flurry with his arms wrapped around his head. It felt like he was being pelted with stones when the tips of the quills struck him. Eragon struggled to close the upper portal without Saphira's help. The moment he did, pain, endless, mind-numbing pain, ripped open his back. He screamed once and went hoarse from the strength of his cry. His vision flashed with red and yellow, then faded to black as he toppled to his side. Below, he heard Saphira howl with frustration. The staircase was too small, and outside the wind was too ferocious for her to reach him. His connection with her receded. He surrendered to the waiting darkness as a release from his agony. A sour taste filled Eragon's mouth when he woke. He did not know how long he had been lying on the floor, but the muscles in his arms and legs were knotted from being curled into a tight ball. The storm still assailed the tree, accompanied by a thudding rain that matched the pounding in his head.
"Saphira!"
"I'm here! Can you come down?"
"I'll try."
He was too weak to stand on the pitching floor, so he crawled to the stairs and slid down one at a time, wincing with each impact. Halfway down, he encountered Saphira, who had jammed her head and neck as far up the stairs as she could, gouging the wood in her frenzy.
"Little one."
She flicked out her tongue and caught him on the hand with its rough tip. He smiled. Then she arched her neck and tried to pull back, but to no avail.
"What's wrong?"
"I'm stuck."
"You're..."
He could not help it. He laughed, even though it hurt. The situation was too absurd. She snarled and heaved her entire body, shaking the tree with her efforts and knocking him over. Then she collapsed, panting.
"Well, don't just sit there grinning like an idiot fox. Help me."
Fighting the urge to giggle, he put his foot on her nose and pushed as hard as he dared, while Saphira twisted and squirmed while she attempted to free herself. It took more than 10 minutes before she succeeded. Only then did Eragon see the full extent of the damage to the stairwell. He groaned. Her scales had cut through the bark and obliterated the delicate patterns grown out from the wood.
"Oops,"
said Saphira. "At least you did it, not me. The elves might forgive you. They'd sing dwarf love ballads night and day if you asked them to." He joined Saphira on her dais and huddled against the flat scales of her belly, listening as the storm roared about them. The wide membrane became translucent whenever lightning pulsed in jagged shards of light.
"What time do you think it is?"
"Several hours before we must meet Oromis. Go on, sleep and recover. I will keep guard."
He did just that, despite the trees churning. Why do you fight? Oromis's timepiece buzzed like a giant hornet, blaring in Eragon's ears until he retrieved the bauble and wound the mechanism. His bashed knee had turned purple. He was sore, both from his attack and the elves' dance of snake and crane,
and he could do no more than croak with his ragged throat. The worst injury, though, was his sense of foreboding that this would not be the last time Durza's wound would trouble him. The prospect sickened him, draining his strength and will. "So many weeks passed between attacks," he said. "I began to hope that maybe, just maybe, I was healed. I suppose sheer luck is the only reason I was spared that long." Extending her neck, Saphira nuzzled him on the arm.
"You know you aren't alone, little one. I'll do everything I can to help."
He responded with a weak smile. Then she licked his face and added,
"You should get ready to leave."
"I know." He stared at the floor, unwilling to move, then dragged himself to the wash closet where he scrubbed himself clean and used magic to shave. He was in the middle of drying himself when he felt a presence touch his mind. Without pausing to think, Aragorn began to fortify his mind, concentrating on an image of his big toe to the exclusion of all else. Then he heard Oromis say,
"Admirable, but unnecessary. Bring Zarok with you today."
The presence vanished. Aragorn released a shaky breath. "I need to be more alert," he told Saphira. "I would have been at his mercy if he were an enemy."
"Not with me around."
When his ablutions were complete, Aragorn unhooked the membrane from the wall and mounted Saphira, cradling Zarok in the crook of his arm. Saphira took flight with a rush of air, angling toward the crags of Telnair. From their high vantage point, they could see the damage the storm had wreaked on Duweldenvarden. No trees had fallen in Ellesmira, but farther away, where the elves' magic was weaker, numerous pines had been knocked over. The remaining wind made the crossed branches and trees rub together, producing a brittle chorus of creaks and groans. Clouds of golden pollen as thick as dust streamed out from the trees and flowers. While they flew, Aragorn and Saphira exchanged memories of their separate lessons from the day before. He told her what he had learned about ants and the ancient language, and she told him about downdrafts and other dangerous weather patterns and how to avoid them. Thus, when they landed, and Oromis interrogated Aragorn about Saphira's lessons, and Gleda interrogated Saphira about Aragorn's, they were able to answer every question.
"Very good, Aragorn Vodur."
"Aye, well played, Bjartskuller,"
added Gleda to Saphira. As before, Saphira was sent off with Gleda, while Aragorn remained on the cliffs. Although this time he and Saphira were careful to maintain their link, so as to absorb each other's instruction. As the dragons departed, Oromis observed,
"Your voice is rougher today, Aragorn. Are you sick?"
"My back hurt again this morning."
"Ah, you have my sympathy."
He motioned with one finger.
"Wait here."
Aragorn watched as Oromis strode into his hut, and then reappeared, looking fierce and warlike, with his silver mane rippling in the wind, and his bronze sword in hand.
"Today," he said, "we shall forego the Rimgar, and instead cross our two blades, Naegling and Zarok. Draw thy sword and guard its edge as your first master taught you."
Aragorn wanted nothing more than to refuse. However, he had no intention of breaking his vow or letting his resolve waver in front of Oromis. He swallowed his trepidation. "This is what it means to be a rider," he thought. Drawing upon his reserves, he located the nub deep within his mind that connected him to the wild flow of magic. He delved into it, and the energy suffused him.
"Geoloth du Nifer," he said,
and a winking blue star popped into existence between his thumb and forefinger, jumping from one to the next as he ran it down Zarok's perilous length. The instant their swords met, Aragorn knew that he was as outmatched by Oromis as by Durza and Arya. Aragorn was an exemplary human swordsman, but he could not compete with warriors whose blood ran thick with magic. His arm was too weak and his reflexes too slow. Still, that did not stop him from trying to win. He fought to the limits of his abilities, even if in the end it was a futile prospect. Oromis tested him in every conceivable manner, forcing Aragorn to utilize his entire arsenal of blows, counterblows, and underhand tricks. It was all for naught. He could not touch the elf. As a last resort, he tried altering his style of fighting, which could unsettle even the most hardened veteran.
All it got him was a welt on his thigh.
"Move your feet faster," cried Oromis. "He who stands like a pillar dies in battle. He who bends like a reed is triumphant."
The elf was glorious in action, a perfect blend of control and untamed violence. He pounced like a cat, struck like a heron, and bobbed and wove with the grace of a weasel. They had been sparring for almost 20 minutes when Oromis faltered. His narrow features clamped in a brief grimace. Eragon recognized the symptoms of Oromis's mysterious illness and lashed out with Zarok. It was a low thing to do, but Eragon was so frustrated he was willing to take advantage of any opening, no matter how unfair, just to have the satisfaction of marking Oromis at least once. Zarok never reached its target. As Eragon twisted, he overextended and strained his back. The pain was upon him without warning. The last thing he heard was Sephira shouting, "Eragon!" Despite the intensity of the fit, Eragon remained conscious throughout his ordeal. Not that he was aware of his surroundings, only the fire that burned in his flesh and prolonged each second into an eternity. The worst part was that he could do nothing to end his suffering, but wait and wait. Eragon lay panting in the cold mud. He blinked as his vision came into focus and he saw Oromis sitting on a stool next to him. Pushing himself onto his knees, Eragon surveyed his new tunic with a mixture of regret and disgust. The fine russet cloth was caked with dirt from his convulsions on the ground. Muck filled his hair as well. He could sense Sephira in his mind, radiating concern as she waited for him to notice her.
"How can you continue like this?" she fretted. "It'll destroy you!"
Her misgivings undermined Eragon's remaining fortitude. Sephira had never before expressed doubt that he would prevail, not at Dras Leona, Gilead, or Fardendur, nor with any of the dangers they had encountered. Her confidence had given him courage. Without it, he was truly afraid.
"You should concentrate on your lesson," he said.
"I should concentrate on you!"
"Leave me alone!"
He snapped at her like a wounded animal that wants to nurse its injuries in silence and in dark. She fell silent, leaving just enough of their connection intact so that he was vaguely aware of Glada teaching her about fireweed, which she could chew to help her digestion. Eragon combed the mud from his hair with his fingers, then spat out a globule of blood.
"Bit my tongue."
Oromis nodded, as if it were to be expected.
"Do you require healing?"
"No."
"Very well. Tend to your sword. Then bathe and go to the stump in the glade and listen to the thoughts of the forest. Listen, and when you hear no more, come tell me what you have learned."
"Yes, master."
As he sat on the stump, Eragon found that his turbulent thoughts and emotions prevented him from mustering the concentration to open his mind and sense the creatures in the hollow, nor was he interested in doing so. Still, the peaceful quality of his surroundings gradually ameliorated his resentment, confusion, and stubborn anger. It did not make him happy, but it did bring him a certain fatalistic acceptance.
"This is my lot in life, and I'd better get used to it, because it's not about to improve in the foreseeable future."
After a quarter of an hour, his faculties had regained their usual acuity, so he resumed studying the colony of red ants that he had discovered the day before. He also tried to be aware of everything else that was happening in the glade, as Oromis had instructed. Eragon met with limited success. If he relaxed and allowed himself to absorb input from all the consciousnesses nearby, thousands of images and feelings rushed into his head, piling on top of one another in quick flashes of sound and colour, touch and smell, pain and pleasure. The amount of information was overwhelming. Out of pure habit, his mind would snatch one subject or another from the torrent, excluding all the rest, before he noticed his lapse and wrenched himself back into a state of passive receptivity. The cycle repeated itself every few seconds. Despite that, he was able to improve his understanding of the ants' world. He got his first clue as to their genders when he deduced that the huge ant in the heart of their underground lair was laying eggs, one every minute or so, which made it, her, a female. And when he accompanied a group of red ants up the stem of their rosebush, he got a vivid demonstration of the kind of enemies they faced. Something darted out from underneath a leaf and killed one of the ants he was bound to. It was hard for him to guess exactly what the creature was, since the ants only saw fragments of it, and in any case they placed more emphasis on smell than vision. If they had been people, he would have said that they were attacked by a terrifying monster the size of a dragon, which had jaws as powerful as the spiked portcullis at Tirm and could move with whiplash speed. The ants ringed in the monster like grooms working to capture a runaway horse. They darted at it with a total lack of fear, nipping at its knobbed legs and withdrawing an instant before they were caught in the monster's iron pincers. More and more ants joined the throng. They worked together to overpower the intruder, never faltering, even when two were caught and killed and when several of their brethren fell off the stem to the ground below. It was a desperate battle, with neither side willing to give quarter. Only escape or victory would save the combatants from a horrible death. Aragorn followed the fray with breathless anticipation, awed by the ants' bravery and how they continued to fight in spite of injuries that would incapacitate a human. Their feats were heroic enough to be sung about by bards throughout the land. Aragorn was so engrossed by the contest that when the ants finally prevailed, he loosed an elated cry so loud it roused the birds from their roosts among the trees. Out of curiosity, he returned his attention to his own body, then walked to the rosebush to view the dead monster for himself. What he saw was an ordinary brown spider, with its legs curled into a fist, being transported by the ants down to their nest for food. Amazing! He started to leave, but then realized that once again he had neglected to keep watch over the myriad other insects and animals in the glade. He closed his eyes and whirled through the minds of several dozen beings, doing his best to memorize as many interesting details as he could. It was a poor substitute for prolonged observation, but he was hungry, and he had already exhausted his assigned hour. When Aragorn rejoined Oromus in his hut, the elf asked, "How went it?" "Master, I could listen night and day for the next 20 years and still not know everything that goes on in the forest." Oromus raised an eyebrow. "You have made progress." After Aragorn described what he had witnessed, Oromus said, "But still not enough, I fear. You must work harder, Aragorn. I know you can. You are intelligent and persistent, and you have the potential to be a great rider. As difficult as it is, you have to learn to put aside your troubles and concentrate entirely on the task at hand. Find peace within yourself, and let your actions flow from there."
"I'm doing my best."
"No, this isn't your best. We shall recognize your best when it appears."
He paused thoughtfully.
"Perhaps it would help if you had a fellow student to compete with. Then we might see your best. I will think on the matter."
From his cupboards, Oromus produced a loaf of freshly baked bread, a wood jar of hazelnut butter, which the elves used in place of actual butter, and a pair of bowls that he ladled full of a vegetable stew that had been simmering in a pot hung over a bed of coals in the corner fireplace. Aragorn looked at the stew with distaste. He was sick of the elves' fare. He longed for meat, fish or fowl, something hearty that he could sink his teeth into, not this endless parade of plants.
"Master," he asked to distract himself, "why do you have me meditate? Is it so that I will understand the doings of the animals and insects, or is there more to it than that?"
"Can you think of no other motive?"
Oromus sighed when Aragorn shook his head.
"Always it is thus with my new students, and especially with the human ones. The mind is the last muscle they train or use, and the one that they regard the least. Ask them about swordplay, and they can list every blow from a duel a month old. But ask them to solve a problem or make a coherent statement, and, well, I would be lucky to get more than a blank stare in return. You are still new to the world of grammary, as magic is properly called. But you must begin to consider its full implications."
"How so?"
"Imagine for a moment that you are Galbatorix, with all of his vast resources at your command. The Varden have destroyed your Urgal army with the help of a rival dragon rider,
who you know was educated, at least in part, by one of your most dangerous and implacable foes, Brom. You are also aware that your enemies are massing in Sorda for a possible invasion. Given that, what would be the easiest way to deal with these various threats, short of flying into battle yourself? Aragorn stirred his stew to cool it while he examined the issue. It seems to me, he said slowly, that the easiest thing would be to train a corps of magicians. They wouldn't even have to be that powerful. Force them to swear loyalty to me in the ancient language, then have them infiltrate Surda to sabotage the Varden's efforts, poison wells, and assassinate Nasuada, King Orin, and other key members of the resistance.
And why hasn't Galbatorix done this yet?
Because, until now, Surda was of negligible interest to him, and because the Varden have dwelled in Farthendur for decades, where they were able to examine every newcomer's mind for duplicity, which they can't do in Surda, since its border and population are so large.
Those are my very conclusions, said Oromis. Unless Galbatorix forsakes his lair in Urubane, the greatest danger you are likely to encounter during the Varden's campaign will come from fellow magicians. You know as well as I how difficult it is to guard against magic, especially if your opponent has sworn in the ancient language to kill you, no matter the cost. Instead of attempting to first conquer your mind, such a foe will simply cast a spell to obliterate you, even though in the instant before you are destroyed, you will still be free to retaliate. However, you cannot fell your murderer if you don't know who or where he is.
So sometimes you don't have to bother taking control of your opponent's mind.
Sometimes, but it's a risk to avoid.
Oromis paused to consume a few spoonfuls of stew.
Now, to address the heart of this issue. How do you defend yourself against anonymous enemies who can contravene any physical precautions and slay with a muttered word?
I don't see how. Unless...
Aragorn hesitated, then smiled.
Unless I was aware of the consciousnesses of all the people around me, then I could sense if they meant me harm.
Oromis appeared pleased by his answer.
Even so, Aragorn Finnierel, and that's the answer to your question. Your meditations condition your mind to find and exploit flaws in your enemy's mental armor, no matter how small.
But won't another magic user know if I touch their mind?
Aye, they will know, but most people won't. And as for the magicians, they will know, they will be afraid, and they will shield their minds from you out of their fear, and you will know them because of it.
Isn't it dangerous to leave your consciousness unguarded? If you're attacked mentally, you could easily be overwhelmed.
It is less dangerous than being blind to the world.
Aragorn nodded. He tapped his spoon against his bowl in a measured meter of time, engrossed in his thoughts. Then said,
"It feels wrong."
"Oh? Explain yourself."
"What about people's privacy? Brom taught me to never intrude in someone's mind unless it was absolutely necessary. I guess I'm uncomfortable with the idea of prying into people's secrets, secrets that they have every right to keep to themselves." He cocked his head. "Why didn't Brom tell me about this, if it's so important? Why didn't he train me in it himself?"
"Brom told you," said Oromis, "what was appropriate to tell you under the circumstances. Dipping into the pool of minds can prove addictive to those with a malicious personality or a taste for power. It was not taught to prospective riders, though we had them meditate as you do throughout their training, until we were convinced that they were mature enough to resist temptation. It is an invasion of privacy, and you will learn many things from it that you never wanted to. However, this is for your own good and the good of the Varden. I can say from experience and from watching other riders experience the same that this, above all else, will help you to understand what drives people. And understanding begets empathy and compassion, even for the meanest beggar in the meanest city of Alagasia. They were quiet for a while, eating. Then Oromis asked,
"Can you tell me,
What is the most important mental tool a person can possess? It was a serious question, and Aragorn considered it for a reasonable span before he ventured to say, "Determination." Boromir tore the loaf in half with his long white fingers.
"I can understand why you arrived at that conclusion. Determination has served you well in your adventures. But no, I meant the tool most necessary to choose the best course of action in any given situation. Determination is as common among men who are dull and foolish as it is among those who are brilliant intellects. So no, determination cannot be what we're looking for."
This time Aragorn treated the question as he would a riddle, counting the number of words, whispering them out loud to establish whether they rhymed, and otherwise examining them for hidden meaning. The problem was he was no more than a mediocre riddler, and had never placed very high in Carvajal's annual riddle contest. He thought too literally to work out the answers to riddles that he had not heard before, a legacy of Garrow's practical upbringing. "Wisdom," he finally said, "wisdom is the most important tool for a person to possess."
"A fair guess, but again, no. The answer is logic. Or to put it another way, the ability to reason analytically. Applied properly, it can overcome any lack of wisdom, which one only gains through age and experience."
Aragorn frowned.
"Yes, but isn't having a good heart more important than logic? Pure logic can lead you to conclusions that are ethically wrong, whereas if you are moral and righteous, that will ensure that you don't act shamefully."
A razor-thin smile curled Oromus's lips. "You confuse the issue. All I wanted to know was the most powerful tool a person can have, regardless of whether that person is good or evil. I agree that it's important to be of a virtuous nature, but I would also contend that if you had to choose between giving a man a noble disposition or teaching him to think clearly, you'd do better to teach him to think clearly. Too many problems in this world are caused by men with noble dispositions and clouded minds. History provides us with numerous examples of people who were convinced that they were doing the right thing and committed terrible crimes because of it. Keep in mind, Aragorn, that no one thinks of himself as a villain, and few make decisions they think are wrong. A person may dislike his choice, but he will stand by it, because even in the worst circumstances, he believes that it was the best option available to him at the time. On its own, being a decent person is no guarantee that you will act well, which brings us back to the one protection we have against demagogues, tricksters, and the madness of crowds, and our surest guide through the uncertain shoals of life. Clear and reasoned thinking. Logic will never fail you, unless you're unaware of, or deliberately ignore, the consequences of your deeds.
"If elves are so logical," said Aragorn, "then you must all agree on what to do."
"Hardly," averred Oromus. "Like every race, we adhere to a wide range of tenets, and as a result we often arrive at differing conclusions, even in identical situations. Conclusions, I might add, that make logical sense from each person's point of view. And although I wish it were otherwise, not all elves have trained their minds properly."
"How do you intend to teach me this logic?"
Oromus's smile broadened.
"By the oldest and most effective method, debating. I will ask you a question, then you will answer and defend your position."
He waited while Aragorn refilled his bowl with stew.
"For example, why do you fight the Empire?"
The sudden change of topic caught Aragorn off guard. He had a feeling that Oromus had just reached the subject that he had been driving toward all along.
"As I said before, to help those who suffer from Galbatorix's rule, and to a lesser extent, for personal vengeance."
"Then you fight for humanitarian reasons?"
"What do you mean?"
"That you fight to help the people who Galbatorix has harmed, and to stop him from hurting any more."
"Exactly," said Aragorn.
"Ah, but answer me this, my young rider. Won't your war with Galbatorix cause more pain than it will ever prevent? The majority of people in the Empire live normal, productive lives, untouched by their king's madness.
How can you justify invading their land, destroying their homes, and killing their sons and daughters?
Aragorn gaped, stunned that Oromis could ask such a question.
Galbert Torix was evil, and stunned because no easy reply presented itself. He knew that he was in the right, but how could he prove it?
Don't you believe that Galbert Torix should be overthrown?
That is not the question.
You must believe it, though, persisted Aragorn. Look what he did to the riders.
Dunking his bread in his stew, Oromis resumed eating, letting Aragorn fume in silence. When he finished, Oromis folded his hands in his lap and asked,
Have I upset you?
Yes, you have.
I see. Well then, continue to ponder the matter until you find an answer. I expect it to be a convincing one.
Black Morning Glory. They cleared the table and took the dishes outside, where they cleaned them with sand. Oromis crumbled what remained of the bread around his house for the birds to eat, then they returned inside. Oromis brought out pens and ink for Aragorn, and they resumed his education in the Lidwyn Kvedi, the written form of the ancient language, which was so much more elegant than the humans' or dwarves' runes. Aragorn lost himself in the arcane glyphs, happy to have a task that required nothing more strenuous than rote memorization. After hours spent over the paper sheets, Oromis waved a hand and said,
Enough. We will continue this tomorrow.
Aragorn leaned back and rolled his shoulders, while Oromis selected 5 scrolls from their nooks in the wall.
2 of these are in the ancient language, 3 are in your native tongue. They will help you to master both alphabets, as well as give you valuable information that would be tedious for me to vocalize.
Vocalize?
With unerring accuracy, Oromis's hand darted out and plucked a massive 6th scroll from the wall, which he added to the pyramid in Aragorn's arms.
This is a dictionary. I doubt you can, but try to read it all.
When the elf opened the door for him to leave, Aragorn said,
Master...
Yes, Aragorn.
When will we start working with magic?
Oromis leaned on one arm against the doorway, caving in on himself as if he no longer possessed the will to remain upright. Then he sighed and said,
You must trust me to guide your training, Aragorn. Still, I suppose it would be foolish of me to delay any longer. Come, leave the scrolls on the table and let us go explore the mysteries of Gramarye.
On the greensward before the hut, Oromis stood looking out over the crags of Telnir, his back to Aragorn, his feet shoulder-width apart, and his hands clasped in the small of his back. Without turning around, he asked,
What is magic?
The manipulation of energy through the use of the ancient language.
There was a pause before Oromis responded,
Technically, you are correct. And many spellcasters never understand more than that. However, your description fails to capture the essence of magic. Magic is the art of thinking, not strength or language. You already know that a limited vocabulary is no obstacle to using magic. As with everything else you must master, magic relies on having a disciplined intellect.
Brom bypassed the normal training regimen, and ignored the subtleties of Gramarye to ensure that you had the skills you needed to remain alive.
I, too, must distort the regimen in order to focus on the skills that you will likely require in the coming battles. However, whereas Brom taught you the crude mechanics of magic, I will teach you its finer applications, the secrets that were reserved for the wisest of the riders. How you can kill with no more energy than moving your finger, the method by which you can instantaneously transport an item from one point to another, a spell that will allow you to identify poisons in your food and drink, a variation on scrying that allows you to hear as well as to see, how you can draw energy from your surroundings and thus preserve your own strength, and how you can maximize your strength in every possible way.
These techniques are so potent and dangerous they were never shared with novice riders such as yourself. But circumstances demand that I divulge them and trust that you won't abuse them.
Raising his right arm to his side, his hand a hooked claw, Oromis proclaimed,
Adurna.
Aragorn watched as a sphere of water coalesced from the brook by the hut and floated through the air until it hovered between Oromus's outstretched fingers. The brook was dark and brown under the branches of the forest, but the sphere, removed from it, was as colourless as glass. Flecks of moss, dirt, and other bits of detritus floated inside the orb. Still gazing toward the horizon, Oromus said, "Catch." He tossed the sphere back over his shoulder toward Aragorn. Aragorn tried to grab the ball, but as soon as it touched his skin, the water lost cohesion and splashed across his chest.
"Catch it with magic," said Oromus. Again he cried, "Adurna,"
and a sphere of water gathered itself from the surface of the brook and leaped into his hand like a trained hawk obeying its master. This time Oromus threw the ball without warning. Aragorn was prepared, though, and said, "Risa Duadurna," even as he reached for the ball. It slowed to a halt a hair's breadth from the skin of his palm.
"An awkward word choice," said Oromus, "but workable nevertheless."
Aragorn grinned and whispered,
"Thrister."
The ball reversed its course and sped toward the base of Oromus's silver head. However, the sphere did not land where Aragorn had intended, but rather shot past the elf, whipped around, and flew back at Aragorn with increased velocity. The water remained as hard and solid as polished marble when it struck Aragorn, producing a dull thunk as it collided with his skull. The blow knocked him sprawling on the turf, where he lay stunned, blinking as pulsing light swam across the sky.
"Yes," said Oromus. "A better word might be letter or codther."
He finally turned to look at Aragorn and raised an eyebrow with apparent surprise.
"Whatever are you doing? Get up, we can't lay about all day."
"Yes, master," groaned Aragorn.
When Aragorn got back on his feet, Oromus had him manipulate the water in various ways, shaping it into complex knots, changing the colour of light that it absorbed or reflected, and freezing it in certain prescribed sequences, none of which proved difficult for him. The exercises continued for so long that Aragorn's initial interest faded and was replaced by impatience and puzzlement. He was chary of offending Oromus, but he saw no point to what the elf was doing. It was as if Oromus were avoiding any spells that would require him to use more than a minimal amount of strength.
"I've already demonstrated the extent of my skills. Why does he persist in reviewing these fundamentals?"
He said, "Master, I know all of this. Can we not move on?" The muscles in Oromus's neck hardened, and his shoulders were like chiselled granite for all they moved. Even the elf's breathing halted before he said,
"Will you never learn respect, Aragorn Vodr?" "So be it."
Then he uttered four words from the ancient language in a voice so deep that their meaning escaped Aragorn. Aragorn yelped as he felt each of his legs enveloped by pressure up to the knee, squeezing and constricting his calves in such a way that made it impossible for him to walk. His thighs and upper body were free to move, but other than that, it was as if he had been cast in lime mortar.
"Free yourself," said Oromus.
Here now was a challenge that Aragorn had never dealt with before. How to counter someone else's spells? He could sever his invisible bonds using one of two different methods. The most effective would be if he knew how Oromus had immobilized him, whether by affecting his body directly or using an external source, for then he could redirect the element or force to disperse Oromus's power. Or he could use a generic, vague spell to block whatever Oromus was doing. The downside to this tactic was that it would lead to a direct contest of strength between them.
"It had to happen sometime," thought Aragorn. He entertained no hope of prevailing against an elf.
Assembling the required phrase, he said,
"Losna kalfia iet,"
"release my calves." The surge of energy that deserted Aragorn was greater than he had anticipated. He went from being moderately tired from the day's pains and exertions to feeling as if he had hiked over rough terrain since morn. Then the pressure vanished from his legs, causing him to stagger as he regained his balance.
Oromus shook his head. "Foolish," he said, "very foolish. If I had committed more to maintaining my spell, that would have killed you. Never use absolutes.
Absolutes?
Never word your spells so that only two outcomes are possible, success or death. If an enemy had trapped your legs and if he was stronger than you, then you would have expended all of your energy trying to break his spell. You would have died with no chance to abort the attempt once you realized that it was futile.
How do I avoid that? Asked Aragorn.
It's safer to make the spell a process that you can terminate at your discretion. Instead of saying, release my calves, which is an absolute, you could say, reduce the magic imprisoning my calves. A bit wordy, but you could then decide how much you wanted your opponent's spell decreased, and if it was safe to remove it entirely. We will try again. The pressure returned to Aragorn's legs as soon as Oromis mouthed his inaudible invocation. Aragorn was so tired he doubted he could provide much opposition. Nevertheless, he reached for the magic. Before the ancient language left Aragorn's mouth, he became aware of a curious sensation as the weight constraining his legs lessened at a steady rate. It tickled and felt like he was being pulled out of a mire of cold, slick mud. He glanced at Oromis and saw the elf's face scribed by passion, as if he clung to something precious that he could not bear to lose. A vein throbbed at one of Oromis's temples. When Aragorn's arcane fetters ceased to exist, Oromis recoiled as if he had been pricked by a wasp, and stood with his gaze fixed on his two hands, his thin chest heaving. For perhaps a minute he remained thus. Then he drew himself upright and walked to the very edge of the crags of Taelnair, a lone figure outlined against the pale sky. Regret and sorrow welled in Aragorn. The same emotions that had gripped him when he first saw Gleyda's mutilated foreleg. He cursed himself for being so arrogant with Oromis, so oblivious to his infirmities, and for not placing more confidence in the elf's judgment. I'm not the only one who must deal with past injuries. Aragorn had not fully comprehended what it meant when Oromis said that all but the slightest magic escaped his grasp. Now he appreciated the depths of Oromis's situation and the pain that it must cause him, especially for one of his race who was born and bred with magic. Aragorn went to Oromis, knelt, and bowed in the fashion of the dwarves, pressing his bruised forehead against the ground. Ebrithil, I beg your pardon. The elf gave no indication that he had heard. The two of them lingered in their respective positions while the sun declined before them. The birds sang their evening songs, and the air grew cool and moist. From the north came the faint, offbeat thumps of Saphira and Gleda's wingstrokes as they returned for the day. In a low, distant voice, Oromis said, "We will begin anew tomorrow, with this and other subjects." From his profile, Aragorn could tell that Oromis had regained his customary expression of impassive reserve. "Is that agreeable to you?"
"Yes, master," said Aragorn, grateful for the question.
"I think it best if from now on you endeavour to speak only in the ancient language. We have little time at our disposal, and this is the fastest way for you to learn."
"Even when I talk to Saphira?"
"Even then."
Adopting the elven tongue, Aragorn vowed, "Then I will work ceaselessly until I not only think but dream in your language."
"If you achieve that," said Oromis, replying in kind, "our venture may yet succeed."
He paused.
"Instead of flying directly here in the morning, you will accompany the elf I send to guide you. He will take you to where those of Ellesmere practice swordplay. Stay for an hour, then continue on as normal."
"Won't you teach me yourself?" asked Aragorn, feeling slighted.
"I have naught to teach. You are as good a swordsman as ever I have met. I know no more of fighting than you, and that which I possess and you do not, I cannot give you. All that remains for you is to preserve your current level of skill."
"Why can't I do that with you, master?"
"Because I do not appreciate beginning the day with alarm and conflict." He looked at Aragorn, then relented and added,
and because it will be good for you to become acquainted with others who live here. I am not representative of my race. But enough of that. Look, they approach. The two dragons glided across the flat disk of the sun. First came Glader with a roar of wind, blotting out the sky with his massive bulk before he settled on the grass and folded his golden wings. Then Saphira, as quick and agile as a sparrow beside an eagle. As they had that morning, Oromis and Glader asked a number of questions to ensure that Aragorn and Saphira had paid attention to each other's lessons. They had not always, but by cooperating and sharing information between themselves, they were able to answer all of the questions. Their only stumbling block was the foreign language they were required to communicate in.
"Better," rumbled Glader afterward. "Much better."
He bent his gaze toward Aragorn.
"You and I will have to train together soon."
"Of course, Skulblaka."
The old dragon snorted and crawled alongside Oromis, half-hopping with his front leg to compensate for his missing limb. Darting forward, Saphira nipped at the end of Glader's tail, tossing it into the air with a flip of her head, like she would to break the neck of a deer. She recoiled as Glader twisted round and snapped at her neck, exposing his enormous fangs. Aragorn winced and too late covered his ears to protect them from Glader's roar. The speed and intensity of Glader's response suggested to Aragorn that this was not the first time Saphira had annoyed him throughout the day. Instead of remorse, Aragorn detected an excited playfulness in her, like a child with a new toy, and a near-blind devotion to the other dragon.
"Contain yourself, Saphira," said Oromis.
Saphira pranced backward and settled on her haunches, though nothing in her demeanour expressed contrition. Aragorn muttered a feeble excuse, and Oromis waved a hand and said,
"Be gone, both of you."
Without arguing, Aragorn scrambled onto Saphira. He had to urge her to take flight, and once she did, she insisted on circling over the clearing 3 times before he got her to angle toward Ellesmere.
"What possessed you to bite him?" he demanded.
He thought he knew, but he wanted her to confirm it.
"I was only playing."
It was the truth, since they spoke in the ancient language, yet he suspected that it was but a piece of a larger truth.
"Yes, and at what game?"
She tensed underneath him.
"You forget your duty." "By..."
He searched for the right word. Unable to find it, he reverted to his native speech.
"By provoking Glader, you distract him, Oromis, and me, and hinder what we must accomplish. You've never been so thoughtless before."
"Do not presume to be my conscience."
He laughed then, heedless for a moment of where he sat among the clouds, rolling to his side until he almost dropped from the peak of her shoulders.
"Oh, rich irony, that! After the times you told me what to do!"
"I am your conscience, Saphira, as much as you are mine. You've had good reason to chastise and warn me in the past, and now I must do the same for you. Stop pestering Glader with your attentions."
She remained silent.
"Saphira?"
"I hear you."
"I hope so."
After a minute of peaceful flying, she said,
"2 seizures in 1 day. How are you now?"
"Sore and ill," he grimaced. "Some of it's from the Rimgar and sparring, but mostly it's the after effects of the pain. It's like a poison, weakening my muscles and clouding my mind. I just hope that I can remain sane long enough to reach the end of this training. Afterward, though, I don't know what I'll do. I certainly can't fight for the Varden like this."
"Don't think about it," she counselled. "You can do nothing about your condition, and you'll only make yourself feel worse. Live in the present, remember the past, and fear not the future, for it doesn't exist and never shall. There is only now."
He patted her shoulder and smiled with resigned gratitude. To their right, a goshawk rode a warm air current, while it patrolled the broken forest for signs of furred or feathered quarry. Aragorn watched it, pondering the question that Oromis had given him. How could he justify fighting the Empire when it would cause so much grief and agony?
I have an answer,
said Saphira. What is it?
That Galbatorix has...
She hesitated, then said,
No, I won't tell you. You should figure this out for yourself.
Saphira, be reasonable.
I am. If you don't know why what we do is the right thing, you might as well surrender to Galbatorix for all the good you'll do.
No matter how eloquent his pleas, he could extract nothing more from her, for she blocked him from that part of her mind. Back in their eyrie, Eragon ate a light supper and was just about to open one of Oromus's scrolls when a knock on the screen door disturbed his quiet. Enter, he said, hoping that Arya had returned to see him. She had. Arya greeted Eragon and Saphira, then said, I thought that you might appreciate an opportunity to visit Teildari Hall and the adjacent gardens, since you expressed interest in them yesterday. That is, if you aren't too tired. She wore a flowing red kirtle, trimmed and decorated with intricate designs wrought in black thread. The colour scheme echoed the queen's robes and emphasised the strong resemblance between mother and daughter. Eragon pushed aside the scrolls. I'd be delighted to see them.
He means we'd be delighted, added Saphira.
Arya looked surprised when both of them spoke in the ancient language, so Eragon explained Oromus's command. An excellent idea, said Arya, joining them in the same language. And it is more appropriate to speak thus while you stay here. When all three of them had descended from the tree, Arya directed them westward toward an unfamiliar quadrant of Ellesmira. They encountered many elves on the path, all of whom stopped to bow to Saphira. Eragon noticed once again that no elf children were to be seen. He mentioned this to Arya, and she said,
Aye, we have few children. Only two are in Ellesmira at the present, Dusan and Olana. We treasure children above all else because they are so rare. To have a child is the greatest honour and responsibility that can be bestowed upon any living being.
At last they arrived at a ribbed, lancet arch, grown between two trees, which served as the entrance for a wide compound. Still in the ancient language, Arya chanted,
Root of tree, fruit of vine, let me pass by this blood of mine.
The two archway doors trembled, then swung outward, releasing five monarch butterflies that fluttered toward the dusky sky. Through the archway lay a vast flower garden, arranged to look as pristine and natural as a wild meadow. The one element that betrayed artifice was the sheer variety of plants. Many of the species were blooming out of season or came from hotter or colder climates and would never have flourished without the elves' magic. The scene was lit with the gem-like flameless lanterns, augmented by constellations of swirling fireflies. To Saphira, Arya said,
Mind your tail, that it does not sweep across the beds.
Advancing, they crossed the garden and pressed deep into a line of scattered trees. Before Eragon quite knew where he was, the trees became more numerous and then thickened into a wall. He found himself standing on the threshold of a burnished wood hall without ever having been conscious of having gone inside. The hall was warm and homey, a place of peace, reflection, and comfort. Its shape was determined by the tree trunks, which on the inside of the hall had been stripped of their bark, polished, and rubbed with oil until the wood gleamed like amber. Regular gaps between the trunks acted as windows. The scent of crushed pine needles perfumed the air. A number of elves occupied the hall, reading, writing, and in one dark corner, playing a set of reed pipes. They all paused and inclined their heads to acknowledge Saphira's presence.
Here you would stay, said Arya. Were you not rider and dragon?
It's magnificent, replied Eragon. Arya guided him and Saphira everywhere in the compound that was accessible to dragons. Each new room was a surprise. No two were alike, and each chamber found different ways to incorporate the forest in its construction. In one room, a silver brook trickled down the gnarled wall and flowed across the floor on a vein of pebbles and back out under the sky. In another, creepers blanketed the entire room except for the floor in a leafy green pelt adorned with trumpet-shaped flowers with the most delicate pink and white colours.
Arya called it the Liana vine. They saw many great works of art, from Ferths and paintings to sculptures and radiant mosaics of stained glass, all based on the curved shapes of plants and animals. Islanzadi met with them for a short time in an open pavilion.